to headlines. Palestinians hold a funeral procession for a teenager killed by Israeli forces near Ramallah in the occupied West Bank. The UN Climate Summit COP27 opens in Egypt, with calls for action from wealthier nations to address the dire impacts of climate change. Also in the headlines, Russian installed officials in Ukraine's Kherson say that a number of settlements in the region have lost water and power supplies following an act of sabotage. Thanks for joining us. Palestinians in the occupied West Bank are mourning the latest victim of Israeli gunfire. A 18-year-old Musab Nafa was killed near Ramallah during an overnight Israeli raid. He was one of the two Palestinians shot by Israeli forces. The second person was injured and is now in Israeli custody. Israel has been leading a deadly crackdown in the West Bank recently. So far this year, the violence has killed more than 140 Palestinians. The resistance movement Hamas says Palestinians will never rest until they have taken revenge for the killings. It says the Palestinians' blood will be, quote, a curse that haunts the Israeli occupation across Palestine. Former Pakistani Prime Minister Imran Khan has welcomed the government's offer to launch an investigation into the assassination attempt against him. Khan also says his supporters' long march towards the capital, calling for early elections, will resume on Tuesday. The protest march was disrupted by the Thursday shooting attack, which left Khan injured in the leg. The former Prime Minister added that he would not join in person while recovering from his injuries. Khan has accused incumbent Prime Minister Shehbaz Sharif, Interior Minister, and an intelligence official of involvement in the attack. The government and the military have strongly denied the allegation. Khan was ousted in a no-confidence vote in April. Kiev has accused Moscow of using Iranian-made drones in the war in Ukraine. Iran, however, has rejected the allegation, blaming the West for preventing Ukraine from discussing the issue with Tehran.
We agreed with the foreign minister of Ukraine for them to provide us with any evidence that Russia has been using Iranian drones in Ukraine. We had an agreement with Ukraine 2 weeks ago to be held in a European nation. Our political delegation was sent to the country, but unfortunately in the final moments, the Ukrainian side did not show up. The reason was the United States and some European nations, especially Germany, had told Ukraine you want to drink coffee with the Iranians in a European nation while we're trying to impose sanctions due to drones.
Amir Abdullahian made the comments in an address to reporters in the Iranian capital, Tehran. He rejected claims that Tehran has provided Moscow with missiles in the Ukrainian conflict. Amir Abdullahian, however, said that Tehran has provided Russia with a small number of drones but months prior to the war in Ukraine. The top diplomat noted that the Islamic Republic will not remain indifferent on the matter if it is proven to Tehran that Russia has used Iranian drones in the Ukraine war. Amir Abdullahian's comments drew reaction from Ukraine, with President Volodymyr Zelensky accusing Tehran of lying.
The official Iranian representatives have released a statement today. They have decided to admit that they did supply drones for Russian terror, but they were lying in this recognition as well. We are shooting down at least 10 Iranian drones daily, while the Iranian regime claims that it allegedly provided few of them before the start of the full-scale invasion. Only during one day yesterday, 11 Shaheds were destroyed.
Zelensky accused Iran of teaching the Russian military personnel how to use those drones, adding that Moscow pays Tehran for such cooperation. Ukraine in recent weeks has reported a surge in drone attacks on civilian infrastructure, notably targeting power stations and dams using Iranian-made drones. This is while Russia denies its forces have used Iranian drones to attack Ukraine. Iran's defense ministry has unveiled the upgraded Bavar 373 long-range missile system and launched Sayed B-4 missile production line. Saman Kujuri has more.
Iran has unveiled the Bavar 373 missile system with a range of over 300 kilometers. Moreover, the Sayyad B-4 defense missile production line was also inaugurated on Sunday in a ceremony attended by Iran's defense minister, Brigadier General Mohammad Reza Ashtiani. During the test fire, a stationary target was detected at a range of more than 450 kilometers by the optimized radar of the missile system and was tracked at the range of about 405 kilometers and was hit at the range of more than 300 kilometers.
Bavar 373 missile system has successfully hit targets at the range of 305 kilometers. This missile system has been designed to counter long-range targets, ballistic missiles, warplanes, and bombers. Even many technologically advanced countries aspire to have such a high-tech missile system.
The long-range missile has solid fuel and was evaluated during operation for the first time. The detection radar range of the Bavar 373 system has increased from 350 to 450 kilometers, and its engagement radar range has increased from 260 to 400 kilometers.
The missile system has been totally produced and upgraded by Iranian specialists at the Defense Ministry and the Army of the Islamic Republic of Iran. We have been able to upgrade the range of this missile in only 2 years. This shows that we can counter all kinds of threats by using domestically made defensive equipment. As much as the threats advance, the Bavar 373 system and other air defense systems advance ahead of their current threats.
The system's missile range has increased from 200 to 300 kilometers, and its engagement height has increased from 27 to 32 kilometers. In the past couple of years, Iran has reached self-sufficiency in manufacturing different types of missiles to boost its defensive capabilities with the aim of protecting its territorial integrity and national sovereignty. Salman Kujuri, Tehran.
The UN Climate Summit COP27 opens in Egypt amid growing calls for rich countries to compensate poor nations that are most vulnerable to climate change. Delegates from around 200 countries are participating in the event in Sharm el-Sheikh. This year, the summit will be focusing on four areas of the climate crisis, which are mitigation, adaptation, finance, and collaboration. Last month, the UN Secretary, General Antonio Guterres, said the world is facing a catastrophe after a UN report warned of a global warming of 2.8 degrees Celsius by the end of the 21st century. Campaigners say not enough progress has been made since the COP26 summit in Scotland last year. That conference resulted in the Glasgow Pact, which committed signatory nations to lower carbon emissions. This year's summit will run through the 18th of November. UK is bracing for a fresh wave of strikes as nurses vote for their first national action over a pay dispute. More than 300,000 members of the Royal College of Nursing have taken part in the strike ballot, the biggest in the union's 106-year history. Reports show an experienced nurse's salary has fallen by 20% in real terms since 2010. The RCN says the government is exploiting the goodwill and expertise of the nursing staff. The industrial action is set to take place within a few weeks. It's likely to disrupt operations and appointments, even as patients are already facing record waiting lists. However, organizers say the action has the support of patients. The UK is struggling with the cost of living crisis. It has seen a wave of walkouts across various industries in recent months. And staying with the UK, public discontent with the government is lingering. Thousands from across the country descended upon the capital, London, during the weekend to protest against the country's worsening cost of living crisis and to demand a general election. Syed Purisa has been to the protests and sent us this report.
Unaffordable rents, choosing between meals and heating, and tears when the bills arrive. Some of the issues that have drawn thousands from across England to the capital on this rainy day.
Concerned about the future, they're protesting against what they see as years of government inaction has led to a deepening cost of living crisis, a squeeze on people's finances, and pushed public services to the brink.
Organized by the People's Assembly, they've named the demo Britain is Broken, a name that captures the country's multiple crises.
We're going backwards. You know, we've got hungry children. We've got old people living in like freezing cold flats and it's terrible.
I think the reason for the massive inflation is all the money that they printed throughout COVID. 600 billion was printed through COVID, most of which ended up in the hands of rich people.
The government blames the emergency at home on the crises abroad. such as the war in Ukraine and global energy price hikes. The protesters here say it's all the result of more than a decade of conservative rule and that the time for change has come.
I want to see a general election. I don't feel like the Tory party should be able to just put people into power, and especially because they're just keeping, inequality, the hostile environment. They're still putting cuts into our NHS and all our social services. So I just feel they don't really have a democratic mandate to do that. And I think it's important that the country has the right to choose who's in charge, not just the Tory party.
There's no democratic argument, despite the law, to say that we've had three prime ministers in the space of 3 months, in less than a quarter of a year, none of whom can offer any real solution to the problems we've got right now. And there's no excuse for that.
The mass demonstration comes only days after the Bank of England increase interest rates yet again to control double-digit inflation. The new prime minister, Rishi Sunak, is announcing his economic plan later this month, expected to include increased taxes and cuts to public spending, meaning the outlook for ordinary Britons looks gloomier than it is now. Saeed Pereza, London.
A UK official says the government is facing significant and difficult decisions on taxes and spending in an effort to plug a budget shortfall. Cabinet Office Minister Oliver Dowden has told British media that the government will announce key decisions in its autumn statement. He added that efforts will be made to protect the most vulnerable people, but did not comment on the likely measures. Prime Minister Rishi Sunak and Finance Minister Jeremy Hunt will set out plans to cover a shortfall of over $45 billion with the first budget program on the 17th of November. Officials say all measures are being considered, such as an extension to a windfall tax on energy companies. Reports coming out of the Russian-held region of Kherson say the strategic Kakhovka Dam has been hit by Ukrainian military strike. Russian news agencies say that a rocket launched by a U.S.-made HIMARS missile system hit the dam's lock and caused damage. They say six rockets in total were fired toward the dam, but the Russian air defense units repelled the main strikes. The Kakhovka hydroelectric dam was captured by Russian forces in the early days of the war. Meanwhile, Russian installed authorities in the volatile area say that a number of settlements, including the city of Kherson, have lost water and power supplies by, quote, an act of sabotage. Three power lines in the region were damaged in the attack. Kherson officials are blaming Ukraine for the assault. There has been no response from Kiev so far. The situation on the Korean Peninsula has reached a dangerous level. North Korea has fired a record number of missiles in reaction to the U.S. war games with allies like South Korea and Japan. While the military aspect is heating up, there's a shortage of diplomatic moves from the U.S. side. Neither does there seem to be a coherent policy from the U.S. when it comes to North Korea.
Sirens going off in South Korea. Another salvo of North Korean ballistic missiles fired. This is part of Pyongyang's testing blitz. A new annual record for missile launches was set back in June. And just this week, 23 missiles were launched in a single day, setting a new daily record. U.S. officials have indicated that North Korea is ready to conduct a nuclear test at any time. Let's not forget, these missiles have the ability to reach U.S. soil, specifically California. Meanwhile, Washington and Seoul have conducted their biggest ever Air Force drills. North Korea's firing of intercontinental ballistic missiles and more U.S. war games. A dangerous and volatile concoction, a war scenario which, if it were true, would involve nuclear weapons. That was evident from the U.S. side when the U.S. Air Force deployed the two B-1B long-range heavy bombers on the final day of the military exercises. This was the first time B-1Bs have flown to the Korean Peninsula since December 2017. So why is Pyongyang on the offensive? Even though the missile launches grabbed all the attention, less notice were developments in the North Korean nuclear doctrine. In September, North Korea updated a 2013 law setting out its nuclear weapons policies and announced that it would respond to attacks against its nuclear command and control systems by launching a nuclear strike automatically and immediately.
The fundamental mission of our nuclear forces is to deter a war, But our nukes can never be confined to the single mission of war deterrent, even at a time when a situation we are not desirous of at all is created on this land.
The U.S. and its allies in this region better be careful. Even an accidental targeting of anything in North Korea could signal a dangerous reaction, and that could spell nuclear Armageddon.
And with that, we come to an end for this edition of World News.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
The Ocean of Dua.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين Hello everyone, brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi with you with another edition of the program, The Ocean of Dua. In this edition of the program, we'll have a glance at Kumail's supplication and we'll discuss a commentary on that. We'll be back in a few seconds, so stay tuned.
Ya Mawlaya, fa kayfa yabqa fil adhab, wa huwa yarju ma salafa min hilmik, am kayfa tu'limuhu an-nar, wa huwa ya'mulu fadlaka wa rahmatak. كيف يحرقه لهيبها وأنت تسمع صوته وترى مكانه أم كيف يشتمل عليه زفيرها وأنت تعلم ضعفا
Dear listeners, we were discussing this part of the Divine Kumail supplication. يا مولاي فكيف يبقى في العذاب وهو يرجو ما سلف من حلمك My protector, so how should he remain in the chastisement while he has hope for your previous clemency? أم كيف تؤلمه النار وهو يأمل فضلك ورحمتك Or how should the fire cause him pain while he expects your bounty and mercy? أم كيف يحرقه لهيبها وأنت تسمع صوته وترى مكانه Or how should its flames burn him while you hear his voice and see his place? Regarding this part, dear listeners, we said that we have many Quranic verses and traditions implying that the Almighty Allah has mercy upon all the servants, and we have seen that this is the case from the beginning of this very Kumail supplication we've been discussing about. And among those wonders of his mercy is that the divine mercy is granted based upon a few acts seen from the servants. The Almighty Allah, the Holy Essence, grants great blessings for few acts of the servants. And the point is that the key has been given to the servants, to the believers. In fact, it is accessible to the servants on condition that they start the action with the supplication both together. As we explained, action and prayer are two keys among the greatest keys through which the human beings can unlock the doors of Allah's mercy. Now, we are not to discuss at the moment about the action and its relation to Allah's mercy in relation to prayer and treasures of Allah's mercy. Now, the thing we need to know is that the Almighty Allah bestows upon His servants because of both effort and prayer. This means that Allah gives His servants through what is with them and what is not with them. What is with them is their efforts, their actions, and whatever they send forth, their endeavors and everything. But what is not with them is denoted by their indigence and neediness to Allah, and their presentation of poverty and need before Allah. What we have seen and what we exactly are seeing in this part of the Kumail supplication is that the servant, the supplicant, has brought his need and indigence towards Allah. فَكَيْفَ يَبْقَى فِي الْعَذَابُ هُوَ يَرْجُو مَا سَلَفَ مِنْ حِلْمِكَ. This person is in chastisement. He is remaining in the different levels of hellfire he is confined. He has nothing and no one else to turn to except you. That is why he is only hopeful for your mercy and no one else.
My Lord, then how could he remain in torment when he hopefully relies upon your past forbearance, compassion and mercy? And how can the fire cause him suffering when he hopes for your grace and mercy? And how can its roaring flames shower him when you hear his voice and see his plight?
Thank you, Allah, now that we're here, feeling so good about all the things that we went through, knowing that God is pleased with us too. It's not a dream, this is so true. And we know we'll be here forever. The feeling is indescribable, knowing that this is our reward.
The ocean of dua.
So it is with these two keys of action and prayer that man can attract the mercy of Allah, by raising towards Him subhanahu wa ta'ala his efforts, actions, his self and wealth, and by displaying before Him subhanahu wa ta'ala his need, his indigence, his desperation, destitute and non-existence. This is exactly what applies to this part of the Kumail supplication. أَمْ كَيْفَ يَشْتَمِلُ عَلَيْهِ زَفِيرُهَا وَأَنْتَ تَعْلَمُ ضَعْفَهُ. How should its groaning encompass him while you know his weakness? This weakness means that it is presented before the Almighty Allah to attract his mercy. Now, in the next episodes, we will try to have a sufficient look at the levels of indigence and needs presented before the Almighty Allah. For now, we will just move on with our discussion of relationship between prayer and action, and the traditions that the Ahlul Bayt and the Infallibles, alayhimus salam, have been asking the servants to accompany action with prayer together. It should not be correct to try to fathom prayer and dua independent of the norms of Allah, however, because He, the Exalted, has laid for His servants some norms in the universe, and with respect to their affairs and needs, it is that it acts. So people should not to neglect these norms in their affairs and wishes. But prayer is not a substitute for these norms. This is one aspect of prayer we need to be aware of. Of course, Following these norms do not dispense man of prayer, but we need to comprehend this subtle lordly customs in Islam in order to be more successful in getting close to Almighty Allah's mercy and our salvation with these two important keys. We'll try to explain them in the next episode. Thank you for staying with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also visit our website at parsetoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
I need you by my side. I wish to be close to you throughout my life. Ya Allah, oh Allah, be with me all the way.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
The United States is under fire for its efforts to influence cyberspace in the country. That's according to a controversial report by The Intercept, which is based on leaked internal memos, emails and documents of the U.S. Department of Homeland Security. The work is primarily done by Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, which is a DHS sub-agency tasked with protecting critical national infrastructure. The report says the U.S. government has pressured social media platforms to, quote, shape online discourse. The platforms include Twitter and Facebook. The department has justified this pressure on social media platforms by claiming that it wants to fight, quote, disinformation. The plan stemmed from concerns around alleged Russian influence in the 2016 presidential election. It also began to take shape during the 2020 election and over efforts to shape discussions around vaccine policy during the coronavirus pandemic. But how disinformation is defined by the government has not been clearly articulated. There are now concerns that the inherently subjective nature of what could be classified as disinformation will give officials in the Department of Homeland Security a broad opening to make politically motivated determinations about what constitutes dangerous speech. This is while critics say the extent to which the DHS initiatives affect Americans' daily social feeds is unclear.
We must rethink our approach to cybersecurity. Releasing alerts, deploying incident response teams, sharing best practices are important tools. But as the pace and scale of cyber threats that we face expands, so must our response toolkit. We need sustained investment to modernize and protect our most critical federal systems, as well as state and local governments, suffering under budget constraints and increasingly aggressive ransomware operators.
The CISA's domain has gradually expanded to encompass more subjects it believes amount to critical infrastructure. Some believe CISA's goal is to make platforms more responsive to their demands. There are suggestions circulating inside the agency calling for an expansive role for the agency in, quote, shaping the information ecosystem. There are also calls within the agency to closely monitor social media platforms of all sizes, mainstream media, cable news, hyperpartisan media, talk radio, and other online resources. Critics say there is growing evidence that the legislative and executive branch officials are using social media companies to engage in censorship by surrogate. But the growing authoritarian acts by the DHS and the FBI to monitor Americans have raised alarm among civil rights activists. They say the authoritarian nature of such acts are contrary to the U.S. Privacy Act of 1974, which was legislated after the Watergate scandal that led to President Richard Nixon's resignation. The act prohibits state data collection of Americans exercising their First Amendment rights. Critics also say there are no specific legal constraints on the FBI's use of social media. Recently, Snowden sounded the alarm again, warning that the U.S. was expanding its mass espionage activities both inside the U.S. and outside the country.
Iran is remembering a historic day which has come to define its modern history. The day which has been named the Day of Fighting Imperialism falls on the 13th of Aban in the Persian calendar. It is symbolic for Iranians for a number of reasons. First, it represents the day when the founder of Iran's Islamic Republic was forced into exile years before the 1979 Islamic Revolution. On November 4, 1964, Imam Khomeini was forced to leave Iran for Turkey after he lashed at the Pahlavi regime for giving legal immunity to the U.S. forces in Iran. Before the Islamic Revolution, thousands of U.S. soldiers and military consultants were stationed in Iran because the country was seen by the U.S. as a major bulwark against what Americans described as the threat posed by the Soviet Union. The Pahlavi regime was totally dependent on the U.S. for its security needs, and it allowed its military and security apparatus to be taken over by U.S. agents. The capitulation law was criticized as a humiliation for Iranians, and Ayatollah Khomeini was among its fiercest critics. His exile was, and still is, seen by many Iranians as the capitulation of the Shah's regime before the Americans. Ayatollah Khomeini's exile stoked anti-U.S. sentiments among Iranians. The 13th of Aban is also significant for Iranians from another perspective. Shortly after the 1979 Islamic Revolution, Iranian students took over the U.S. Embassy in Tehran for its meddling in the affairs of Iran. The main reason behind the Students' Act was a fear from another U.S. plot against the revolution, which toppled the U.S. puppet regime in Tehran. Over the years, the U.S. has claimed that the thorny relations between Washington and Tehran is because of the U.S. Embassy takeover by Iranian students. However, this is a distorted version of history presented by the U.S. establishment. His recent remarks to Iranian students, the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Khamenei, dismissed the U.S. assertion as a lie. Ayatollah Khamenei said that the starting point of the row goes back to the CIA-orchestrated coup of 1953. Ayatollah Khamenei was referring to the coup against the government of Prime Minister Mohammad Mossadegh, who had nationalized Iran's oil industry. The coup, which was followed by the temporary rule of CIA and MI6-approved General Fazlollah Zahedi, enabled the monarch, Mohammad Reza Pahlavi's return from exile in Italy. It also consolidated the monarch's rule for the following 26 years, until the victory of the Islamic Revolution in 1979, led by Imam Khomeini, which toppled the Pahlavi regime.
It was a long wait that ended in a cry of joy. Former president and left-wing candidate Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva won the second round of the Brazilian presidential election against the incumbent far-right leader Jair Bolsonaro. With 50.9% of the vote, the leader of the Workers' Party obtained a narrow victory over his opponent, who received 49.1% of the vote. The election was Brazil's most polarizing poll since its return to democracy in 1985 after a military dictatorship. It also marked the first time that the sitting president failed to win re-election. Just over 2 million votes separated the two candidates. Addressing his supporters in a speech following the announcement of his victory, the newly elected president promised to unite a divided country. The veteran leftist leader said his win is a victory for a democratic movement above the interests of parties and ideologies.
This is not my victory, nor of the Workers' Party, nor of the parties that supported me in the campaign. It is a victory of the immense democratic movement that was created beyond the political parties, individual interests and ideologies for democracy to win.
Lula made a stunning comeback while the public credited him with building an extensive social welfare program during his previous tenure in office, helping lift millions into the middle class and being in charge of a booming economy. During the election campaigns, Bolsonaro tried to shift the debate to Lula's corruption convictions in 2018, which were later overturned by the country's top court. However, he failed. Bolsonaro's popularity never exceeded 40% during his 4 years in office. He faced wide criticism over a slew of issues, including his handling of the COVID-19 pandemic, inflation, and high fuel prices. He has been widely criticized by public health experts for his failure to respond to the pandemic in a timely fashion and reluctance to introduce restrictive measures in fear of damaging the economy. Just 4 out of 10 households have access to food of adequate quality and quantity. The majority, 58.7%, live with some level of food insecurity. This is equivalent to around 125 million people. Also, large-scale deforestation of the Amazon accelerated under Bolsonaro, reaching a 15-year high in 2021. In his third term, Lula has inherited a sluggish economy, tighter budget constraints, and a more hostile legislature from the country's most right-wing government in decades. Lula has vowed a return to state-driven economic growth and social policies that helped lift millions out of poverty when he governed Brazil from 2003 to 2010. Soon after the announcement of Lula's victory in the tight runoff presidential vote, congratulations poured in. Among the list of world leaders who rushed to express their joy about Lula's victory was a long list of regional leftist leaders, including Argentina's Alberto Fernandez and Mexico's Andrés Manuel López Obrador. Lula's win is the latest example of Latin American countries choosing to dethrone incumbent parties on the right and center-right of the political spectrum. From Mexico in the north to Chile in the south, the region's political map suggests Latin America is set to see a new wave of pink tide of leftist governments that swept into power in the 1990s. The return of leftist governments in the region would bring closer cooperation across Latin America and is a clear indication of region-wide rejection of U.S. policies. Experts believe that the emergence of leftist politicians in Latin America will expand China's circle of friends in the region based on the fact that Latin America will attach more importance to political and economic cooperation with Beijing. Washington has for years backed the wrong players in the region, many educated or trained in the U.S., but Americans have turned a blind eye to the civil society's demands for change in the region, which has meant the departure of the U.S. favorite actors.
The German Chancellor and the French President met in Paris to recalibrate their relations, as there seems to be a rise in tensions over issues related to energy, economy and defense between Europe's two biggest economies. Germany and France are the driving forces behind many of the key decisions made by the European Union, such as a plan to raise billions of euros in debt to cushion the blow of the pandemic.
We are the biggest supporter of Europe. We are paying 26% of the budget usually, and we are developing a lot of solidarity mechanisms, as we did in the last crisis, looking at Corona, with the instruments we developed with the RRF and the recovery fund is a good chance for acting together also in the time we have now.
But amongst the differences in their policies that have become cause for fallouts, Scholz and Macron seem to be on the same page when it comes to seeing European investments being hijacked by the US as a result of new policies in Washington. Macron believes that as businesses are given incentive to, quote, buy American, France will lose 8 billion euros. What Macron is referring to exactly is the biggest climate and energy package in US history, recently signed by Joe Biden. The Inflation Reduction Act of 2022, or the IRA, includes $600 billion in spending in total, with $370 billion dedicated to supporting renewable energy and climate resilience. Washington is hoping to find the budgets for the package by sorting out large corporations' long-running tax evasions, as well as those of the top 1%. Whether or not the corporations and the elite will still be able to evade taxes, as they've been doing for so long, remains to be seen, though. One of the measures in the IRA includes tax rebates for buyers of American-made electric vehicles, among many other industry credits for clean energy initiatives. These incentives will move operations from France to the US to take advantage of these subsidies, according to Macron. He's even called the IRA measures unfairly protectionist. There is agreement among the EU bloc members that tangible and concrete measures need to be taken. Among the potential responses that the EU could give to the IRA policy is filing a complaint to the World Trade Organization that would call for adding European-made products to become a part of the US rebate plan. In an interview with France 2 TV channel, Emmanuel Macron proposed his response to the US measure. We need a Buy European Act like the Americans. We need to reserve our subsidies for our European manufacturers. Macron even referred to similar policies in China, saying, you have China that is protecting its industry, the US that is protecting its industry, and Europe that is an open house. German Chancellor Olaf Scholz, while not a big fan of the Buy European rhetoric, shares Macron's concerns over the unfair US competition. He is especially hurt when he found out that German chemical giant BASF is planning to cut down its business activities in Germany, as the company's chief says the gas prices in Germany are 6 times higher than in the US, and increasing EU regulations aren't helping his business either. German Finance Minister Christian Lindner has acknowledged that and responded by saying, the decision of a successful company like BASF show that we need to improve the overall attractiveness of Germany as a business location. He also said Germany needs to pursue tax relief for private investors. Now Scholz and Macron are trying to reach an agreement with Washington to sort out their differences through a newly formed US-EU task force on the Inflation Reduction Act.
Whoa! Ladies and gentlemen, after years and years of hard work, it's official. Micron is coming to Central New York.
It remains to be seen whether the deindustrialization that is plaguing Europe, mainly as a result of the energy crunch that is causing the exodus of European countries from the bloc, but now also because of Washington's incentives for investors in the US, can be fixed through reaching a compromise with the US. Because the alternative would be either a transatlantic trade war or an even bigger economic slump for a Europe unattractive to companies and investors, new and old.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
The limelight.
The economic damage caused by the coronavirus era, the scandals and incompetence of Boris Johnson's government, the economic wrongdoings of the government after Johnson, led by Liz Truss, and the increase in energy and food prices due to the conflict in Ukraine, go hand in hand to bring Britain's economy into the longest recession in the past 100 years. We have taken a look at some of the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The website, thebusinessstandard.com, has more for us. The Bank of England has warned the UK risked being plunged into the longest recession in the past 100 years after it pushed up the cost of borrowing to 3% in the biggest single interest rate rise since 1989. The Bank of England said a 0.75 percentage point increase, the latest in a series of 8 interest rate rises since last year, would not be enough to guarantee victory in the war against double-digit inflation, as it cautioned further action would be needed. Britain's economy faces a very challenging outlook, with a recession that began this summer now expected to last until the middle of 2024. With the possibility of a general election being held in 2024, the Conservatives face campaigning to remain in government at the tail end of a prolonged slump, during which the Bank of England said it expected unemployment to rise from 3.5% to 6.5%. However, there was some relief for mortgage holders as the central bank downplayed city expectations of a steep rise in the cost of borrowing to above 5%, arguing that the prospect of a 2-year recession meant it was likely to take a much less aggressive stance. Andrew Bailey, the Bank of England's governor, said, "We can't make promises about future interest rates, but based on where we stand today, we think the bank rate will have to go up by less than currently priced in financial markets." The last time British rates rose to more than 0.5 percentage point was in 1989. John Major's government was forced into a 2% rise during the exchange rate mechanism crisis in 1992, though for less than 24 hours before it was scrapped. The British newspaper The Guardian has more for us. The Bank of England now expects inflation, which hit 10.1% in September, to peak at 11% by the end of 2022, and then to fall probably quite sharply from the middle of 2023. It blamed higher energy prices and a tight labour market for the big increase, which matched aggressive rises in recent days by the US Federal Reserve and the European Central Bank, the ECB. The vote to raise interest rates was split 7-2 among the 9 members of the Monetary Policy Committee after Silvana Tonreiro voted for a 0.25 percentage point increase and Swati Dingra voted for a 0.5 percentage point jump. Both are professors at the London School of Economics. They argued the full effects of 8 consecutive rises should be allowed to feed through into the wider economy before more severe action was taken. The Chancellor of the Exchequer, Jeremy Hunt, said inflation is the enemy and is weighing heavily on families, pensioners and businesses across the country. That is why this government's number one priority is to grip inflation. And today the Bank of England has taken action in line with their objective to return inflation to target. Rachel Reeves, the Shadow Chancellor, said families now face higher mortgages and more anxiety after months of economic chaos. Rachel Reeves added, "Working people are paying the price for Tory failure. Britain deserves more than this." On alternative assumptions that interest rates remained unchanged at 3%, the economy would still continue contracting until the end of 2023, but a cumulative fall in output would be 1.7% rather than 2.9%, and unemployment would peak at just over 5%. The Bank of England said it had not factored in any action by Jeremy Hunt in his autumn statement on 17th of November. Though the Chancellor of the Exchequer is expected to announce a package of tax increases and spending cuts worth up to £50 billion. The Reuters news agency has covered the same story from a different angle. The British Retail Consortium, BRC, said on Wednesday, 2nd of November, the cost of fresh food in British shops last month was 13.3% higher than a year earlier, the biggest annual increase in records going back to 2005. The British Retail Consortium, a trade body, said its broader measure of shop price inflation picked up to 6.6% in October from 5.7%, while food prices overall rose 11.6% as the cost of less perishable foodstuffs rose more slowly than prices of fresh items. The British Retail Consortium's chief executive, Helen Dickinson, said, "It has been a difficult month for consumers who not only faced an increase in their energy bills but also a more expensive shopping basket." Britain's official measure of consumer price inflation, which covers a wide range of goods and services including soaring energy bills, returned to a 40-year high of 10.1% last month. And the Bank of England expects it will peak this month at nearly 11%. Outsized rises in the cost of food have come under particularly close attention, and some anti-poverty and anti-obesity charities have reported that shoppers are turning to more calorific processed foods to save money. The British Retail Consortium said retailers were under pressure from rising energy bills, staff cuts and commodity prices, and urged the government to freeze a planned £800 million rise in business property taxes, which shops would pass on to their customers. Helen Dickinson said, "While some supply chain costs are beginning to fall, this is more than offset by the cost of energy, meaning a difficult time is ahead for retailers and households alike." Andy Clark, chair of the operational improvement company Newton Europe, said Christmas will be challenging for British households who are already facing high fuel costs and rising energy bills. He added, "Everyone wants to enjoy Christmas, but you've got to take a view that certainly for the next 3 to 6 months, we're not going to see any rapid decline in inflation. It's going to be a tough winter, and food inflation is clearly adding to the burden of families."
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa. And FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.